Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representations as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any information presented. This information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. On today's call, we have investment directors Richard Chauvin, Martin Serrera, and Jeff Tangus, Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton, and serving as our moderators, our Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's call. A lot to talk about today, as always, and we're going to switch things up a little bit. We've been starting the calls talking about the trade situation, and obviously a lot to talk about there. But we thought it'd be appropriate, really, to talk about the economy. And Paul Teton, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Hey. I guess, you know, during the third quarter, a lot of other strategists and economists, we began to hear as numbers came in some pretty dire expectations of where we were from a growth expectation standpoint. You had a few economists out there starting to talk about recession. And when you have that sort of pessimism or negativity, when you get a number like we got for the third quarter GDP, it was somewhat of a surprise, even though there was nothing super exciting about the number. And it was pretty much in line with Hancock Whitney Asset Management expected. So if you could, let's start off maybe talking about the third quarter GDP number, which was released last week. Just a little color around that and maybe talk a little bit about where you think things are so far. I mean, we're about halfway through the fourth quarter, almost a third of the way through. So give us some color on that as well. Paul?
Sure. Well, so we have been projecting 2 to 2.5% real GDP growth on a trend basis, meaning the year-to-year growth rate in the second half. So the quarter-to-quarter numbers get more focus in the financial press. They tend to be pretty noisy and jump around and get revised. So we think the better handle is the year-to-year growth rate. But for what it's worth, the third quarter, as you mentioned, did come in a little better than expected at 1.9% quarter-to-quarter. Importantly, the year-to-year growth rate was right at 2%. So right in the target range, but right at the lower end of it, of what we've been projecting. So that's down from 3.2% in the middle of 2018, and basically the trade war has had a pretty significant impact in slowing U.S. growth from that 3.2 to 2%. In the third quarter, the consumer pretty much was carrying the economy. Nothing too exciting at 2.9% real personal consumption expenditure growth. That's down from 4.6 in the second quarter, although that number was probably a little on the high side after a very weak first quarter due to the government shutdowns and lots of other concerns. So it looked like there was a bounce back in the second quarter and back to a little more normal behavior in the third quarter. The capital spending parts of the economy are in something of a funk. Commercial construction fell sharply for the second quarter in a row, and technology hardware spending was also weak in the quarter. One bright spot was residential construction. Housing market has finally responded to the decline in interest rates and had a 5% quarter. Again, not to not super exciting, and it's such a small sector now compared to what it was 10 years ago. It really doesn't move the needle much, but it's a small sector of strength in the economy. So looking forward, the signals continue to look on the soft side, and expectations for the fourth quarter are on a quarter-to-quarter basis in the 1.5 to 2% range. So even at 1.5, that probably, our estimation is that that pulls the year-to-year growth rate maybe down to 1.9. So a little bit of drift below what we had seen as the likely range. We're revising our expectations going forward for the next 12 months to 1.5 to 2% growth rate on the year-to-year basis. And so probably at the top end of that for at least the foreseeable future, next quarter or two. And the main components of that slower outlook are that the labor market, while we had a better than expected report in October, labor growth, non-farm payroll growth is slowing. Was growing at about 225,000 a month for non-farm payrolls last year. That slowed to about 175. So there's a bunch of signs of a maturing labor force as the economy slowly approaches capacity. One of those is the job leavers percentage is high, meaning that companies are pulling workers, skilled workers, out of other companies to fill their jobs. So our expectation is that non-farm payrolls probably are going to continue to slow and gradually begin to put some upward pressure on the unemployment rate. All that said, we see recession risks as pretty low going forward, just a little slower growth in the U.S. economy.
Paul, you touched on a theme, you know, in talking about the third quarter that I think is really been here with us for the better part of 2 years, and that the consumer, you know, is really driving the economy, and due to a lot of the uncertainty around trade, businesses are apparently unwilling to invest or spend. And how long can that carry forward? Is it you know, at some point, if businesses don't start to invest and make capital expenditures, you see consumers begin to fade off because the employment picture changes. Just talk a little bit about that, on how long the consumer can continue to carry us.
Well, I think basically the bottom line is that the consumer can continue to carry the economy for a while anyway, let's say the next 12 months. But only modestly so it's really a soft landing picture in the U.S., again, with low recession risk. So we've talked about job growth being healthy. Consumer confidence is high, although it's as high relative to expectations as it ever gets. And so there's probably room for the consumer to get a little gloomier if various news items and things were to present that. Wage growth has been pretty modest at 3%. That's better than what we had for most of the last decade, around 1.5-2. But the real rub is that the labor participation rate is low, meaning it's limited opportunities for low-skilled workers, and the low level of the ratio of employed to the population means we've got a pretty low level of employment relative to the size of our economy. And that's been a governor on real disposable income growth and real personal consumption expenditure growth. These have been limited at modest growth rates, kind of, you know, 2.5-3% rates we've been seeing. We never got to a robust consumer sector this cycle, and it doesn't appear that we're likely to get there. All that said, it does look like there's no reason to think that we won't have a pretty decent selling season this Christmas. So trying to leave that, hand that back to you on a positive note.
All right. Great. Thank you, Paul. Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Hey, so you heard Paul's comments about the economy. The Fed met, I guess it was October 30th was the meeting, I believe. And cut rates as expected, another 25 basis points. That was the third time they've eased in the last 3 months. And, you know, pretty much a change of course from what we expected as we entered 2019, as we come to the end of 2019. Talk a little bit about, why the Fed felt it was necessary to cut another 25 basis points. And what's always important is some of the commentary that comes out of the press conference. Talk a little bit about what Jay Powell said in terms of where we go from here.
Sure. Well, Paul talked a little bit about the state of the economy and some of the headwinds that the economy faces. So the Fed's very aware of what's going on with not just U.S. growth, but global growth. The Fed's mandate, it's important to remember, is one, full employment, and two, stable prices. So the Fed's very, very sensitive to what's going on in the economy. They have to be because that's what translates into full employment. So with a slowing domestic economy and a slowing global economy, the Fed had some things to worry about, and they realize that. They've cut three meetings in a row now as what has been termed an insurance cut against the economy, possibly stalling out and maybe tipping over into recession. It seems that they've been successful in that regard, in that the market generally supports the three moves that they have made. And the market also feels like it's appropriate for the Fed to go ahead and move to the sidelines, which Jay Powell said they were going to do in his post-meeting press conference here in the most recent meeting. There's precedent for this type of move, three cuts and a pause, as it's been called. In the mid-90s, the Fed did this a couple times, actually. They call a mid-cycle adjustment. So the Fed followed the established precedent there and cut three times, and then Jay Powell in his post-meeting press conference was very transparent. He came out and said that he felt like interest rates were in a good place and the Fed would like to take a pause to see what the impact is of these cuts. And it looks at this point that they're probably on hold till March, April, May, or June, sometime late first quarter, maybe early second quarter-ish of 2020 before they really start to make another move. And at that point, if the economy has continued to slow, they're likely to put in additional cuts. If the economy actually improves, they're not likely to do anything, because one of the other things that is new to come out of the Fed at the last meeting is the Fed basically said they're going to let the economy run a little hot if they have that opportunity. If inflation, which has been very, very low recently, and inflation expectations have been very, very low, if inflation did start to come back, they're going to be more reactive and slow to raise interest rates. They want to give the economy every opportunity to pick up steam. So it looks like, as far as the Fed is concerned, they're on hold at least for the next several months.
Okay. And let's talk about other maturities. So obviously when we're talking about the Fed, we're talking about overnight rates. And what the Fed does really has a lot of influence over short maturities, right? Year or so. Where the Fed is and what they might do really influences where yields are there. But for longer maturities, there's a lot of other factors that could influence moves. You touched on one of them, inflation. Talk a little bit about, I guess it was back in August where we were talking about the yield curve inverting. Talk a little bit about where we are on longer maturities and why we've seen, I guess, a drift upward since that time in August when we were talking about inverted yield curves.
Well, you're right. The Fed controls short-term interest rates. The market controls longer-term interest rates. And there are a myriad of factors that go into it. But the most prominent recent factors in August was the flight to quality, when it appeared that globally things were slowing down rapidly. and that maybe a trade resolution wasn't going to take place and Brexit wasn't going to get fixed, and lots of all these risks to the marketplace were out there. There was a big flight to quality around the world. The U.S. Treasuries, our U.S. markets are still the deepest and most liquid markets. People from around the world put money in our Treasury bonds when they feel like there's uncertainty. So we saw that certainly in August, and as things sort of tempered and prospects for a trade deal looked a little brighter, we started to see money flow out of Treasury bonds, and longer term interest rates at that point started to move a little higher after dropping precipitously in the month of August. So that was a major factor recently, and it appears that the flight to safety trade is really tailing off. The other aspect of longer term interest rates is inflation, and I mentioned that just a second ago. Inflation expectations continue to be historically very low. The Fed's favorite indicator of long-term inflation points to something in that 1.7% annual rate of inflation for 10 years or so. So people in general just don't think inflation is going to be an issue. The Fed is sensitive to that. The Fed wants stable inflation. They don't want inflation to get too low. They targeted 2%, and so far they've not been able to get inflation up to 2%. So that's been a big factor on the longer end. But most recently, longer end rates have trended up a little higher on brighter prospects for a trade deal and for Brexit. But it's not likely that they move significantly higher from here. They're sort of range-bound with negative interest rates still prominent in Europe. It'll just be very difficult for our longer-term interest rates to move dramatically higher.
Okay. And, Jeff, lastly, if you could maybe just 30 seconds to a minute on corporate debt or you know, what we call spread product. You know, you spent all your time so far talking about treasuries. Talk about other types of debt instruments or fixed income investment. What's going on
there? Corporate bonds have been phenomenally popular this year. They took a hit last year in the fourth quarter along with stocks, and like stocks this year have rallied back very strong to near record low spreads. Right now the index that we follow is about a plus 82 on an intermediate term corporate bond investment grade index, plus 82 basis points to treasuries. And so that's very near the low end of the range. So it's not likely that those spreads will grind much lower since we're already historically low. Much more likely is that they trade in a range over the coming months as it becomes clearer, I guess, what the economy will look like next year, as well as trade and some of the other uncertainties that face the global economy.
All right. Thank you much, Jeff. Martin Serrera, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So good month for stocks. I was kind of looking at some numbers this morning, and it was interesting because really for most of the third quarter, even to the first week of October, you know, stocks basically move sideways with a fair amount of volatility. And I guess these last 3 weeks or so, market participants have gotten energized and, I guess, excited, namely about some progress on trade deals, but other things. There were corporate earnings also fairly positive, which I know you'll talk about in a minute. Just looking at the numbers in October, I guess the other thing that sort of stood out, and we'll just call U.S. stocks, regardless of small, mid, large, up, call it 2.5%. International, for the first time in seems like forever, bested U.S. stocks by a pretty decent margin. International developed or IFA stocks up 3.6, emerging market stocks up 4.2%. So if you could maybe talk a little bit about the month and the current environment, in terms of what's been really the catalyst or the driver.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, picking up on a point that Jeff just made about the flight to quality in the early part of the quarter, pushing Treasury yields down, stocks were going down into early August in the, during that flight to quality. And then since the August low point, the S&P 500 is up over 8%. But it has been also, as you described, a volatile period. So sideways for most of the quarter. And in that volatility, we reached another interim low point in the beginning of October. And then October turned out to be a really strong event. And you touched on some of the highlights. S&P 500 up about 2%. EFA index up over well over 3%. Large cap U.S. growth stocks continue to drive domestic returns. The Russell 1000 growth index is up 275 for the month of October. While the Russell 1000 value is up only 123. Interestingly, what we would sometimes call a risk on environment, mid and small cap continue to lag, especially mid cap stocks. So the small cap index up almost 2%. But behind the S&P 500 during the month, mid-cap stocks way behind at 1%. I think as you highlighted, and I'll touch on a little bit later, certainly optimism about progress in trade talks is one of the big current drivers of market outlook. But there's also a few other things being reflected in prices. One thing is just sort of a contrary movement in prices. You know, most of the psychology lately has been negative. As a matter of fact, the American Association of Individual Investors regularly surveys investor attitudes, and those attitudes for most of the quarter were fairly negative about stocks. And usually that's a very strong contrarian indicator, and then this time it has been as well. That, you know, when those attitudes are at their lowest, a pretty good signal that stocks are going to head higher.
Okay. So and you sort of touched on it, but expectations for the near term, and I know that's always a difficult question, but just give us some thoughts on maybe how the year ends, and then as we move into 2019, what will be some of the catalysts or drivers? What are your expectations?
Yeah, so earnings progress this year has been pretty weak, and that's likely to continue into the fourth quarter. The third quarter is looking better than analysts expected it to look, but I think we're still going to post an S&P 500 earnings decline when all the numbers are all tallied. We're currently at a blended growth rate of about -2.5%, -3%, which is better than it was in early October, but that's still pretty weak, and that would be the third negative quarter in a row, although the first two quarters were negative by a fraction of 1%. But we're in an environment that's similar to the 2015-2016 manufacturing slowdown, and Paul touched on this a bit earlier with investment spending, and you and Paul went back and forth about investment spending. It's one of the most talked about effects of the trade troubles we've been having in tariffs is that businesses have been curtailing investment spending just on uncertainty, and that's really showing up in some of these growth expectations. So as we look ahead, we're very very attuned, as you see in all of our discussions, very attuned to trade conversation, and Richard's going to talk about that as soon as I finish here. And so if we get meaningful progress and good news on trade, maybe that works in favor of the uncertainty and the negativity around investment spending. In the meantime, as Paul talked about earlier, we've been having decent growth on the consumer side. The one positive in corporate fundamentals that has stuck out over the full year, even through these couple of negative quarters of earnings growth, is that top-line revenue growth has been I call it fairly healthy in a low growth environment. We're gonna probably post a number of well over 3% for the third quarter top line revenue growth, and that expectation is actually rolling into 2020. That number is expected to go higher. And of course, as we get in 2020, the math changes. 2018 was the year of the tax cut boom. 2019, we're comparing to those big growth numbers in 2018, so the comparisons are not so favorable. But 2020, that's out of the picture now, and so maybe we'll get some good organic growth, and we'll continue on this trend. A couple of headwinds: political uncertainty, valuations are not terribly attractive, although they're not awful. So our best expectation is continued volatility with probably an upward tilt like we've experienced for the last couple of months.
Great. Richard Chauvin, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So you heard all of our speakers leading up to you, and businesses want answers and clarity on this U.S.-China issue that's been with us forever. Are we finally going to get some?
I think we'll get some of the clarity that they would like if things turn out as we hope and as the market seems to expect based on its recent performance. So, yes, I think some clarity is coming.
So there's been a lot of headlines just, within the last couple weeks where it looks like we're coming to, I think you've referred to it as a skinny deal or a phase one deal. Talk a little bit about where we are on that and what that might look like if it happens.
Sure will. And I will say up front that in just recent days, the phase one deal, and I call it a phase one deal because the administration has spoke about it in terms of it probably three phases. Phase one is the one we're going to focus on, and that's because doing a whole deal, as we've learned, is pretty much impossible to do at this point in the political cycle. So phase one, there's a possibility it could be growing in size, which is good and bad. It's good because it could potentially lead to more things being put on the table and agreed to. It also increases the risk of a deal falling apart if they reach too far and can't come to agreement. What's in play and what China – I'll start with what China wants. China wants to have rollback in some tariffs that got put on in September. They want the planned December 15th tariff increase that Trump has announced earlier. They want that suspended. They even have talked that they want some of the original tariff put on $250 billion of goods that goes back many months into the early summer. They would like to see those pared back. Again, they're reaching for as much of a rollback as they can get. The administration, of course, is weighing these requests carefully. And they're going to want something in return for each of those elements. So there's going to be a tit for tat agreement, or there's not. But some of the things China will be asked to give up if we're going to roll back or suspend any tariffs would be things like more certainty on agricultural purchases in the future, larger amounts and more certainty on those amounts. Probably tighter controls over currency manipulation or currency movements, probably reducing or removing caps on foreign ownership of companies operating in China. Those are the types of things. Oh, and I should mention they also would like Huawei relief, the large telecommunication company in China. They would like to have relief on that.
Okay.
So lots in play right now.
Yeah. So just simple yes or no. You do think that some sort of a skinny deal or a phase one deal is likely, correct?
I do think some type of deal is likely. We'll call it skinny, even though it may grow. Yes.
And then a longer term comprehensive deal, still seems like a bit of a reach where we address some of those more difficult issues of intellectual property and technology transfer. You know, it's possible, but that's less probable, especially as we get closer to the election. Fair statement?
I would rule it out before the election. I don't see any possibility of China putting those type of important issues, in their view, on the table when there's a possibility there could be a new administration come late 2020. So, no, I don't think that's possible.
Okay. And we've spent, and really the financial press has spent a lot of time talking about U.S.-China trade negotiations, but even probably you could argue more important deal is the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, or NAFTA 2.0, that we seem like we're making some headway and progress on getting that passed. If you could just maybe a brief minute on that.
Sure will. And I checked the betting markets. There's betting markets on just about everything now. And so the chances of a USMCA deal passing this year are less than a third today. But the chances of one passing sometime in 2020 are pretty high, something like 70%. So there is growing optimism about the passage of a deal. And there's a lot of elements to this that probably don't have time to get into. But it does, I'll just mention, it does involve the potential for drug pricing relief. Congress wants to be able to, and particularly the Democrats, want to be able to show that they accomplished something in this term, because they really haven't accomplished a lot legislatively. And there's a chance for them to get drug pricing relief in this UMCA deal, so that would be one element of success for them. They don't have the support of labor unions in this deal right now, but they still may be able to get the numbers to pass it. But the calendar's short, so probably can't happen this year.
All right. And lastly, Brexit. Thought we were sort of coming to a head on October 31. It looks like we've yet again kicked the can a little further down the road, but this might be it, right? December the 12th is the big date. Just talk a little bit about where we are in that situation, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay, sure will. So the Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, was not successful in getting out of the EU by the October 31st deadline. Parliament wouldn't allow it. They would not consider his negotiated deal with the EU that they had in front of them. They wanted time to study it. The EU was asked to grant a delay. They granted a 90-day delay, so at the latest, the Brexit would come at the end of January of next year. Johnson then called for a snap election to change the makeup of Parliament. That was originally being forbidden by the Labour Party, but they decided to agree to that after the threat of a hard Brexit was eliminated by this extension. And so now the main uncertainty is what happens with that election. It seems from the polls that the Conservatives, the Tories, have the numbers to get a majority back in Parliament, but there's lots of uncertainty about that because polling is notoriously poor. There's been lots of surprises in polling versus voting. So there's still very much uncertainty about how that election will go, but it looks, as you said, like we're coming to the end of the story here after 3+ years.
Great. All right. Well, we look forward to hearing more about it next month. Thank you to all our guest speakers today, and please join us in December when we meet again on December 3rd. Thank you.